You know the Cut and Splice Festival is taking place in Wilton's Music Hall.
Yes, it's my favourite space to play in London so far.
And what is it that you really like about the space?
Well, it's the character. Maybe we're talking about recorded delivery, the character, the woolly sound of the recording, the cheap tape recorder in the parcel or through the post. It's it's not a good digital recording. It's a bit muffly, and that gives it character. It's less than perfect. Like I talk about how humans, if we were all digital, we'd all be boring, right? But it's our imperfections that we pick up, our characteristics, things from friends, and our scars and tears and experiences that make us not perfect, that then make us who we are, characters. So it's the same with sound. Wilson's Music Hall is imbued with a sense of history through its imperfection, and it's beautiful and old and woolly and mouldy and crumbly and undone up and warm and lovable like an old scar.
This is the second episode of the Domestic Soundscape podcast series commissioned by Sound and Music for the 2009 Cut and Splice Festival, Living Rooms. This year's Cut and Splice Festival is all about everyday places, home, and the ordinary. This week's podcast is focused on the idea of rooms and chambers. I first encountered ideas about the relationship between sounds and spaces in 2004 when I met Yannick Schaefer, who you heard me talking with at the beginning of the podcast. Yannick spoke back then about recorded delivery. Unable to gain access to the storage centre where the exhibition was going to be, Yannick Schaefer posted a voice-activated recorder to the site in a package via Royal Mail's recorded delivery service. The resulting recording sounds exactly like what it is, a voice-activated tape cassette recorder being posted in a cardboard box. This satisfying fusion of sound and form in recorded delivery reminds me of Bob Levine's piece, Handmade.
Like there's the handmade piece, the cymbal piece. A record was cut into the cymbal. I got a vinyl cutter onto a cymbal, and the sound that's recorded into it is the sound of somebody playing the cymbal.
So it's like remarrying the source of the sound with the recording, like fusing them back together when they've been taken apart in a recording
process. Yeah. I like the cultural and social consequences of what that recorded sound did, you know? I think I'm interested in that history, that social history, that culture, about those consequences of a technology kind of being invented. I think that's kind of the thing that kind of drives me. It's things like the invention of the phonograph, its invention of the camera, invention of the telescope, you know, all of those sorts of forms of mediation. And also forms of communication as well, like the telegram and technologies that shrunk the world, essentially, that made the world a smaller, faster place. And I see that as a sculptural thing. I see that as time, you know, distance, space. I'm not really excited by kind of taking a mic out and recording stuff. This is where I think I'm really a sculptor at heart. I think I really have been. It's about the space, it's about the distance, it's about the material, it's about, you know, it in the space. It is, it's matter, what it is. The phenomenon, the phenomenology of how we experience it every day. And, you know, when you have something like the phonograph, and it shifted our understanding, physically, our understanding of kind of how we experience it, and it's that core that I'm really into, how it altered our imagination.
Bob's comments there about working sculpturally with sound are key notions for other artists too. Here are composers Yannick and Jennifer Walsh talking about space, volume, sounds and distance.
Sound is a volume, three-dimensional volume. And to make those volumes habitable by making them large, volume loud becomes volume large. You know, a beautiful drone, if it's slithering through the ether very quietly, it's a background sound, but you just turn it up and you feel space through volume.
With the embroidered score, what I was interested in was trying to get a three-dimensional aspect to score. So there's actually three different layers of paper, you know, in the score, and then that's all embroidered together. And so even if you just had those three layers, people would see that as a two-dimensional object, whereas when you embroider it, it instantly steps out towards you. And then if you have those strings flying free, what I would do when I perform the pieces is I would blow the strings. I would blow those loose lying embroidered strings, and then they would move in different directions, you know what I mean? So you had the score that was mobile and flexible. And I always give this in comparison that, like, there's that Earl Brown score, December 1952, which is blocks, and some of them are small and some of them are big. And I would talk to my students and I would say, like, okay, you know, this is the first graphic score, and how are you going to interpret it? Most of them would try and interpret it from left to right, and they would see, you know, a small block is a small sound or a quiet sound, and, you know, a large block is a large sound or a loud sound. And I would say, you know, there's this Father Ted, my favorite Father Ted probably sequence is when Father Ted and Father Dougal are sitting at a table, and Father Ted has a small plastic cow, and he says, and they're sitting at a table in a caravan with cows outside in the field, and he says, now look, for the last time, this cow that I'm holding is small. The one outside the window is far away, small, far away. And this is what I would, like, I would show my students this clip, and I would talk to them and I'd say, look, you know, if you see a small image on a graphic score, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a tiny sound. It could just be a huge sound that's very far away, in the same way that, like, the stars are very far away, but it's a huge amount of energy that's traveled over time to get here. And just to try and get people to stop thinking from left to right, you know, from stop thinking that big has to be loud, you know what I mean? And to just think in three dimensions, and, you know, even four dimensions if possible, you know, just to think in different ways.
The idea Jennifer talked about there of a giant sound that's far away was part of the thinking in Bob Levine's work in the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, where she used metal shoes and distance to explore the different speeds of light and sound.
How these came about was the jumping piece at Yorkshire Sculpture Park, which was sort of an experiment that I've not entirely finished. And they become this heavy weight, so it kind of really dictates the kind of movement. And so what I was kind of... It was a way to make a very loud sound with a very simple action. We know when we look at a human figure, if somebody jumps, it's very clear, because the whole body moves in a certain way, and you don't have to move that dramatically to kind of be identified as someone jumping. And you also know, we know it so familiarly, you know, we know the point of landing. So we know that exact point when the sound should happen. And what was happening in the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, what people were viewing this from 400-500 metres away. So when I would land, you knew, you could see me land, you could see me just about to lift up, you could see me jump, even though it was a small amount, it wasn't a big jump, you could see me land and no sound happened, because they were 400-500 metres away, so the sound took another second and a half to reach them. So you have this kind of cinematic kind of out of sync shift.
I met with Bob when she was at Wilton's Music Hall exploring ideas for her performance at the Cut and Splice Festival, and we did some jumping there too.
Thank you.
Wilton's Music Hall has an amazing acoustic. It's reverberant and creaky, and it amplifies everything inside it. Exploring the space with Bob, I became really conscious of the different rooms and chambers inside the building. One of the most influential pieces of the 20th century in terms of articulating rooms and describing physical spaces is Alvin Lucia's work, I Am Sitting in a Room.
I am sitting in a room different from the one you are in now. I am recording the sound of my speaking voice, and I am going to play it back into the room again and again until the resonant frequencies of the room reinforce themselves, so that any semblance of my speech, with perhaps the exception of rhythm, is destroyed. What you will hear then are the natural resonant frequencies of the room articulated by speech.
A collection of recordings of I Am Sitting in a Room is currently being organised on the Sound and Music website. I put out a call via the Sonic Arts newsletter for versions of this piece to include in the collection. For those of you unfamiliar with the piece, it's a composition by Alvin Lucia. The text of the piece sort of explains itself, so I'll play you another excerpt of the version I made with Mark Vernon.
I am sitting in a room different from the one you are in now. I am recording the sound of my speaking voice, and I am going to play it back into the room again and again until the resonant frequencies of the room reinforce themselves, so that any semblance of my speech, with perhaps the exception of rhythm, is destroyed. What you will hear then are the natural resonant frequencies of the room articulated by speech. I regard this activity not so much as a demonstration of a physical fact, but more as a way to smooth out any irregularities my speech might have.
This text is recorded and played back into the room, then the recording is played back into the room and recorded, and so on. It's like photocopying sound over and over, and as the piece progresses, certain frequencies are emphasised as they resonate time and time again in the room. What is left at the end of I Am Sitting in a Room is an impression of a room's resonant frequencies. One artist who has based several years' work on I Am Sitting in a Room is Jeff Cloak. Here is one of his experiments, derived from Lucia's original work.
I am standing in my hall at home. My words are being picked up by the microphone and will be replayed into the room after a short delay. As this happens again and again, the resonant frequencies of the room will reinforce themselves, gradually transforming my speech into the harmony of the room itself. I'm standing in my hall at home. My words are being picked up by the microphone and will be replayed into the room after a short delay. As this happens again and again, the resonant frequencies of the room will reinforce themselves, gradually transforming my speech into the harmony of the room itself. I'm standing in my hall at home. My words are being picked up by the microphone and will be replayed into the room after a short delay. As this happens again and again, the resonant frequencies of the room will reinforce themselves, gradually transforming my speech into the harmony of the room itself. I'm standing in my hall at home. My words are being picked up by the microphone and will be replayed into the room after a short delay. As this happens again and again, I'm standing in my hall at home. My words are being picked up by the microphone and will be replayed into the room
I chose this example from the large selection Jeff sent me because it's interesting to hear the process performed in domestic space. Many of the other versions I was sent were created in large halls like this version by Charles Stankiewicz, which was recorded in an extremely resonant five-story metro station. I think the version of I Am Sitting in an Office, performed by David Rogerson, Richard Whitelaw, Jonathan Webb and Becca Lawrence of Sound and Music, is also interesting. They made their version of Alvin Lucia's work in their former office, the Sonic Arts Network office, right before moving out of it to merge into the new organisation Sound and Music and its new offices.
We're sitting in a room different from the one you're in now.
We're recording the sounds of our speaking voices, and we are going to play them back into the room again and again.
Until the resonant frequencies of the room reinforce themselves so that any semblance of our speech, with perhaps the exception of rhythm, is destroyed.
What you will hear, then, are the natural resonant frequencies of the room articulated by speech.
The voices of the people we work with every day and the spaces that we work in together can be made to sound new and strange by the piece I Am Sitting in a Room. The resonant frequencies that I Am Sitting in a Room reveal are not normally audible to the ear in the form they take in that piece, but we do hear the resonance in the rooms where we live, and it does affect the way that events sound in those rooms. For instance, when I speak in my bathroom, it sounds very different to when I speak in my kitchen. The domestic soundscape is made up of a complex mix of resonances and discrete sound events. How would it be if one could design domestic spaces sonically, taking all of those elements into account? For most people, a familiar creative act for dealing with domestic space involves decorating a room. I decided to play with this idea in sound. I met with a group of students in the Museum of Domestic Design and Architecture, and we used the museum's current exhibition on home decorating as a starting point for our discussion on sonic wallpaper.
Well, there is that program Sphere that we're going through, and you can actually draw in it, and you can draw sine waves, and you could actually draw that in Sphere and see how it sounds. Not sure, you know, like with all the crossing lines,
yeah,
and tones going up and down.
On some wallpaper, if you were to literally take the image and put it in the software and the software generate that sound, it wouldn't for me anyway, give the representation of that wallpaper. That perception level is much more interesting. Like you say, if that was a wallpaper up all over a wall, how that would make you listen to things differently. Environments definitely have an impact on how you listen to things, how you can concentrate. If you see cornfields on wallpaper, that's the first rule of thumb, don't record cornfields. Just for me anyway, would be the first thing you want to avoid is what you see, because we're not... But I think by completely replicating a wallpaper in sound educates people to look still. It doesn't educate people to listen.
Mm.
They're going to go, oh, that's what I can see.
Yeah.
They're still going to be thinking with their eyes. So I think to be presenting a sound that's completely, seemingly, from first encounters, nothing to do with what you're looking at, would make people want to understand why is what they're hearing, not what they're seeing. Yeah, why am I hearing this?
Yeah, whereas it becomes purely illustrative.
Yeah.
Mm.
If it's like, here's cornfield, here's cornfield.
Yeah. So in that sense, yeah, people would have to engage with what they're listening.
So it's much more about understanding how the wallpaper acts in the room and how sound acts in the room, rather than like, what are you seeing and how...
So if you were to look at it as a sonogram or a waveform, then it is incredibly complex and busy.
Yeah.
Apart from these lines, which you could see would be sustained tones, other than that, you could see a lot of sort of grainy sounds and impulses and clusters of kind of frequency.
But if somebody picked this to go in their house, then actually as a wallpaper it's quite inoffensive and gentle. Then I suppose you start to think about what things could you extrapolate from that in terms of sound, and what kind of fabrics or partitions in the space or curtains or cushions or anything could be used to enhance that sense, and what appliances would be allowed in that room to support that thing. What you said about the wallpaper being the thing that you sort of build the room around, that's really interesting, I think, in terms of if the starting point, instead of like, what is the wallpaper going to be, it was like, what is the soundscape that we're creating in this room, and then if everything was built around that, would be really, it would really change the way that we decorated spaces. Yeah,
very much so.
You are not going out looking wallpaper, it's more like you're standing in the room and you start to imagine what sort of wallpaper it could be. And you sort of have this kind of a very vague idea of what sort of wallpaper you're looking for. And then you go out to look for the wallpaper and just find something like close to your imagination. And maybe that's another way to approach the sonic wallpaper, you know.
We tried a few things. Martin Thompson and Lucia Chung developed a process revolving around the idea of exciting the frequencies of a room using sine tones.
We set a speaker up one side in the living room, and then we put a microphone in the kitchen, so it's one long area, and then we played white noise through the whole space at a reasonable volume, in the hope that we get some discrepancies in that white noise when we played back the recording. So we, it's quite different actually than what we thought. So we analysed that recording, and there's significant volume peaks in that white noise, significant resonance tones. So we just took those tones and created them on their own, so just the sine waves. And then we played those sine waves back into the room, wondering how much those tones would influence and excite the room. And it really was quite surprising. You just press play. I mean, you have to be in the room in the same environment, but you just press play, and all of a sudden, it was every single frequency was everywhere, and it was very difficult to locate where it was coming from. Even going right up to the speaker, it didn't seem like it was coming out of the speaker.
You can see the speaker, but you're looking don't feel at it like you feel immediately feel the
it sounds wrong. Everywhere. But yeah, I mean, it went
but into. Then I, for me, it's like I listened to the sound. I was thinking, try to imagine myself living in that space with this arm, you know. So there's a whole become the whole discussion of, you know, this thing is from this space, it will go, but what about personal preference or even you say like comfort?
Simon James French was interested in the idea of covering a wall with small speakers.
So you step back and you hear the whole sound. Right, when you step closer,
near the individual sounds. You know, I was thinking of different kind of variations of having, if you have an alcove with the speakers beside you going down the wall, so you can step in, hear that one, or just having the speakers in front of you in a kind of 5x5 grid or something like that, 4x4.
So they'd be in the alcoves that way or in the alcoves?
But maybe the one in the alcove going down would be a lot nicer because you could kind of step into the sound.
We talked a bit about sounds that we are used to that act like wallpaper in the way that they are there, but you don't consciously notice them all the time.
I've got a clock that's constantly ticking. I don't seem to ever notice it. If someone was to stay in my room, they would probably be kept up all night by it, but because it's in the background and it's always there, I've just become accustomed to it and completely oblivious to its existence.
Is it a wind-up clock?
No, it's a battery.
Because I have a wind-up clock, and unlike you, I get totally used to it. But as soon as it's wound down, I notice that it's gone. I can really notice that it's stopped, and then I have to wind it back up again. Yeah, it's just like what Barry Truax was saying in his book, saying all these key sounds that people are used to in the city, like, you know, foghorns or cranes and lawnmowers, like we were saying last week, actually. But as soon as they're gone, you do notice.
I started thinking about wallpaper and how it looks, and there's always a theme of repetition. So I thought if you were then to go with the sort of wallpaper idea, you'd have to create some sort of loop. So I attempted to create just a short loop of these sort of sounds that already exist in my room. But what I also noticed was that a lot of the sounds come from elsewhere as well, like from outside or from other rooms. I can hear the television from downstairs or next door or whatever. So I was wondering, could maybe we use this concept of sound bleeding through as a way of transporting us to somewhere else? Because we were talking about, like, you know, exotic wallpapers and how they're like an escape. Could we maybe create a sense of being somewhere else by having sounds playing in other rooms so that they bleed through into whatever space we're in and make us feel as if we're somewhere else?
I chose to deal with the difficult sound of my bathroom fan by inventing two kinds of sonic wallpaper. In one experiment, I devised a score intended to encourage me to sing or find the various pitches within the droning sound. For my other sonic wallpaper idea, I put jam jars in the bottom of my shower so that when I was in it, the sound of the water hitting the top of the jars distracted me from the fan noise. What was most interesting to me about the project at the Museum of Domestic Design and Architecture was how the idea of choosing wallpaper inspired so many different approaches to working with sound. The rituals and language surrounding our design of domestic space are sophisticated in visual terms, but we don't always think in the same way, or as consciously, about the way that our domestic environments sound. One person who has explored this territory a lot is Lise Lefebvre. For her master's degree at the Design Academy in Eindhoven, Lise focused on the influence that domestic appliances have on the soundscape in our homes and devised a way of muffling their sounds using felt. I interviewed Lise on Skype about this project.
Yeah, my starting point was noise pollution, and I came from the point of view that we have so much stuff that we put in our houses and we can customize everything from the color of the walls to the light to the furniture and everything, but there's not any mean to control the quality of the sound in your house. You can add sound, but you can't really protect yourself from sound that are coming from external sources. And so I was really starting to look at ways of isolating the noise and like sound panels, all kind of isolating techniques. And I wasn't really satisfied with that. I just figured that if there's something to be done with the sound, it has to come from the source of the sound, like directly from the production level and where the noise is produced, so technically from appliances and all the kind of noisy objects that we have in our house. And that was pretty much the starting point. So how to make the soundscape of your house, the quality of the sound that are incoming, more pleasant, and then how that ties in together with the visual aspect of the objects. From my experiments, by making the objects more quiet technically, I could also make them, because there's no way to gauge that an object is quiet when you look at it. And it was, I found a really important aspect of it to make it also visually quiet. And that was just bringing a lot more to the overall experience. So that's why I really worked as well on the outside of the appliances. And I have this really thick layer of felt that's just covering all my appliances, and it helps to dampen the sound. It just absorbs all the sound of the motor coming from the appliance, but it's also visually quiet. It's white and fluffy, and I think it just adds to the overall impression of the quietness of the appliance. I did so many experiments with appliances that I turned into musical instruments, making videos of orchestrating the noise in the space. But in the end, it's really hard to communicate to people just on the sound. Like, so many people are not musical, and even I'm not very musical. So it was hard for me to fine-tune the results of these experiments. But then as soon as I started working with the visual aspects together, then it just made sense to everyone looking at the project. And yeah, that's when I really started focusing on the interaction between the sound and the result visually of the experiments. Sounds like there's still a sound, but it's more like a purring animal. It's like a really low vibration type of sound. So I was really quite satisfied with the outcome, because I didn't want to completely kill the sound. I think it's important that those appliances have some kind of a voice, that they still communicate that they're working and things like that. But that designers have the choice to control this voice, and that's our job, to make the voice be in relation to the aesthetic as well, and in relation to what we expect of these appliances, personality-wise, sort of.
One of the things that struck me most whilst talking to Lise about her project was her description of our emotional relationship to the sounds of various appliances.
Part of my research was really our emotional connection to the sound, and killing completely the sound, making it completely silent, is actually really difficult to deal with when you have a completely silent room. Like, if your vacuum cleaner doesn't make any sound, you just assume that it's broken. And so you need some kind of response in that way, but it's really important to be able to fine-tune this sound to make it express what you want from this appliance. Is it really strong? Is it really soft? Is it efficient? Is it, like, you can really assign a personality, I believe, to those appliances through that sound. So that was really what I was working on as well.
When I first moved into the bedsit that I live in, there was a broken tap that made a constant high-pitched hissing sound. I found this a very strange sonic intrusion in my life, and I missed the sounds of my former home, the sounds and acoustics that made me feel I was home. I needed to make my new domestic soundscape familiar and reassuring. So while I was waiting for the property management to fix the tap, I decided to record its sound. I then played this recording back through pillow speakers inside a pillowcase that I printed with the image of a tap, and this formed the basis for an installation I had in an art exhibition. Somehow, this process changed and improved my relationship with this sound. Projects like this one are as much about philosophy as sound. The idea to record the dripping tap came from the Learning to Love You More website created by artists Miranda July and Harold Fletcher. On this website, you can find assignments that cause you to reconsider your relationship to everyday things. Assignment number 58 gave me the idea for my piece, Record the Sound That Is Keeping You Awake. The other assignments on the site concern many aspects of life, often personal aspects, as suggested by the title Learning to Love You More, and domestic space and the sounds within it are personal.
There are a lot of different sounds in my bedroom that are already there that I just completely ignore. I've got a radiator and I've got a clock in there, I've got a computer in there, and strangely a water boiler. It's very noisy in there and I've never sort of noticed. But like you were saying, you know, if these sounds were to disappear,
yeah,
I'd notice. I noticed especially like in my bathroom. My bathroom's very noisy. You can hear all the pipes above, and I find it quite like it's sort of a comfort sound.
Mm.
You know, it makes me feel quite relaxed having those sounds in the background. And so I sort of kind of thought of this concept of comfort sounds. Maybe they could be recordings of these sort of familiar sounds that we're used to, or nostalgic sounds that make us feel quite relaxed. And maybe they could be used in quiet spaces or even quite noisy spaces to sort of create a more comfortable feel. You could have these sort of portable sounds. I had this idea, you know, for when you go away, you stay in a crummy hotel or something.
I was intrigued by this notion of making one's comforting and familiar domestic soundscape portable, so we met to test out a version of the idea. We each made up three recordings of our living spaces from different points within them. Then we set up three stereos roughly corresponding to where each recording was made in our own spaces, and replayed the sounds to see if any sense of the original rooms could be recreated like this.
It's like a really bad photocopy.
Mm. You do get an impression of like the space there. I mean, it's helping me to imagine a completely different space to the one we're in now.
The acoustics of the Moda study room made a very big difference to how our recorded sounds behaved once played back in the space. But there was still a sort of impression, a trace of our own rooms.
A lot of these sounds are bleeding through from other rooms. And I mean, these are all recordings made with, say, my window open or my door open. So what we're also getting is the sounds are also affected by space beyond my room.
Is it this noisy? Like, or is it this noisy when you've got the windows open and the doors open?
When I've got the windows and the doors open. With those closed, you still have these sounds present, but they wouldn't be as loud as this.
This resonant quality isn't just confined to rooms themselves, but also to the spaces inside objects and cavities in our homes. When I stayed with Rachel in her parents' house in the Lake District, she played the sounds of the plumbing to me.
Thank you.
Listening to this got me to thinking about all the spaces and chambers where sounds can resonate inside a home. Cupboards, cooking pots, stairwells, cisterns, pipes, fridges, ovens, Tupperware and tins are all spaces in which sound can resonate. One of Alvin Lucia's scores, Nothing Is Real, involves playing a recording of the Beatles track Strawberry Fields Forever into a teapot via some small speakers. At specific points, the teapot is lifted up, put back down, opened and closed, and so on. And this changes the way sounds resonate within the teapot. I decided to create a version of this piece using four different chambers in my home: my teapot, my oven, my basin, and a cooking pot. I used my flute because with the flute, I've always been aware of the relationship between sound and space, using my own mouth to direct air inside the instrument's chambers. I am certain that in their daily usage I will not hear the Beatles playing from any of these objects, but I am equally sure that having explored their acoustic qualities in this way, I will always now be more aware of how they sound when I make tea, bake bread, wash the dishes, or dye yarn. This for me is the philosophical dimension of art making, the exciting means by which art makes the ordinary extraordinary. And this reminds me of John Cage's hugely influential work, 4 minutes and 33 seconds. This piece instructs the performer not to play their instrument throughout the entire duration of the three movements of the work. The effect of this is that in the strained, expectant atmosphere of the concert situation, the environmental sounds that bleed into the space where the piece is being performed become exposed. Once presented within the tense framework of the concert situation, these environmental sounds receive the rapt listening attention that we normally reserve only for what is conventionally understood or thought of as music. This piece by John Cage is almost a philosophical statement that says we can bring the same attention we would bring to a recital to the everyday sounds that surround us all the time. Adopted as a personal philosophy, this means a biscuit tin can become a concert hall, a kettle boiling can become a performance. It means that the rooms and chambers that we inhabit and use can be explored with the same curiosity and sense of investigation that we normally reserve only for designated cultural activities, like going to concerts or visiting art galleries. That curiosity in daily things, processes and phenomena is behind everything we've heard today, and there are still many ways for us to listen to the rooms and chambers where we live. You've been listening to Felicity Ford and the second episode of the Domestic Soundscape podcast series commissioned by Sound and Music. This podcast was created especially for the Cut and Splice Festival 2009, and full show notes, links and images are available on the Cut and Splice website at www.cutandsplice.com. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next week looking at habits and routines.